Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Staten Island, New York. At the age of 3, he showed interest in a toy drum, and later at age 13, he played a friend's snare drum, which prompted him to buy his first drum set. He has performed with numerous soloists, including The Monkees, Michael Bolton, Cyndi Lauper, Joan Jett, and Bo Diddley. His autobiography, Beat the Odds in Business and Life, addresses business management, the music industry, and Sandy's personal life experience as a drummer and public speaker. His name, Sandy Gennaro. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula, this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Sandy Gennaro, who's performed with Cyndi Lauper, Joan Jett, Bo Diddley, The Monkees, numerous others. Sandy, welcome, an honor to have you.
Thank you very much, Jack. I'm very, very happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to chat with you.
All right, let's go back, Staten Island, New York. Talk about your childhood, your mom and your dad, please.
Well, my childhood was a very happy one and fulfilled one. I grew up on the Lower East Side in a two-bedroom tenement, a five-story walk-up, and I received a drum for Christmas, and that was part one of my defining moment. Because I loved hitting that drum, and it's the only thing in the house that I can hit with sticks and not get hollered at by my mother. So I was very attractive to music growing up. My sisters played 50s rock and roll around the house, and my dad played big band music around the house and always pointed out the drummer. Like he would say, you know, hey, that's Buddy Rich, Sandy. Listen to those drums. He was a very big fan of drumming, my dad was. I borrowed my friend's dad's snare drum, which I saw in his closet when we went to look for a softball that we had lost while we were playing in the street. I saw this snare drum and my eyes lit up. Hey, Freddie, can you ask your dad if I can borrow that? So I ended up borrowing that snare drum. And when I had to give it back, I started crying. I didn't want to give it back. And my mother said, well, save your allowance and we'll get you a drum set. And that's what I did. I got my first drum set at 14 years old and started playing backyard barbecues and high school dances and stuff like that. When I was 16 years old, I got snuck into my first bar. And every time I smell cat pee, I think of that first bar. It was a place called Gigi's on Bay Street in Staten Island. I think now it's a Chinese restaurant. But so that was it. And I started playing bars in the city and the village and the Bitter End and Rock and Roll Cafe and all these places in the city. And that was my childhood, and that was my, you know, getting my feet wet in the music business.
All right, let's go back. February 9th, 1964, 60 years ago, a cultural watershed moment. What do you remember about that day?
What I remember about that date was that there was a huge buildup to that date. A whole week before, radio stations in New York like WNEW, WPLJ were playing this band's material and in anticipation of their first TV appearance in America on February 9, 1964, and it was the appearance that the Beatles made on the Ed Sullivan Show. And it was highly anticipated. I was in front of that black and white TV about a foot away from it. My jaw was agape. I couldn't believe what I was seeing and hearing. But what initially attracted to that, the music and the band, and it was the first time I seen a drummer play, but how the girls reacted to the Beatles on TV, I said to myself, I don't know what's going on there, the way the girls are hysterical seeing a rock and roll band, but I want part of that. And that's part two of my defining moment. I knew exactly what I was going to do for the rest of my life. There was no plan B. There was no nothing else except being a drummer in a rock and roll band, playing great songs in front of a large audience. And that was my vision board. I cut out a picture of a drummer from a drummer standpoint on stage, looking out of a massive crowd. And I scotch taped that picture on my bathroom mirror. And I was 13 when I saw the Ed Sullivan Show with the Beatles. And it was about 2 years I talked to that picture every single day. And when I saw it in my bathroom mirror and said to myself, that's going to be you, Sandy. It's only a matter of time. That's going to be you. That's going to be you. So there was no question. There was no, well, if the chips fall right, or, well, if I get a lucky break, or any of that. When you have any kind of qualifying excuse not to make your dream happen, it negates the whole dream. But when you feel the emotion inside of you, how you would feel if that visualization actually took place, then that's the key. Where you live, you receive your goal and you receive your dream in spirit first, and then you let the God energy, like I call it, or the universe or your higher power, guide you along the way to make that dream happen. And along that way, you continue your work ethic, you continue your treatment of people in a right ethical way. And if you're in that positive vibe, the universe or your God energy or whatever higher power you look up to will take care of that dream. And that's what happened in my life. Exactly what happened as I'm describing it right now.
73 million people watched them on TV. They were paid, Sandy, $2,400 for that first appearance. They sang All My Lovin' Till There Was You. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr. Did you ever meet Ringo?
I met Ringo one time when I was living in Los Angeles. I was coming out of a club in the middle of a day, which I was playing that evening. It was a club on Santa Monica Boulevard called the Starwood in Los Angeles. And I walked out of there, and across the street, there was a shoe store, like a mom-and-pop kind of shoe store. And there was an old-fashioned Rolls Royce parked in front of it with the big grill and the fenders, the slope fenders and whatever. So I said to myself, yeah, I wonder whose car that belongs to. So I wandered in that shoe store, pretending to be interested in a pair of shoes. There was nobody in that store except for Ringo and a friend of his, a male friend of his. I don't know if it was a friend, a bodyguard, or whatever, but they were trying on shoes. Every other chairs were empty, but I sat right next to Ringo, and I asked the salesman to bring out size 8s of whatever style. And while I was waiting for my shoe, I turned to Ringo, and I said, Ringo, it's a pleasure to meet you. He said, nice to meet you, too. What's your name? And I said, Sandy. I'm a drummer, too. He goes, well, good luck. He shook my hand and then went back to his trying on shoes. And that was the only time I met Ringo, ever.
50-plus years later, Sandy Gennaro has performed in front of over a billion people with many, many leading artists. The iconic rock beat, We Will Rock You. How do you explain the explosion of that worldwide?
How do I explain that? Well, I was given the good fortune of playing in a German band called Kraft. I did their record in 1985, and they asked me to tour in support of that record. They made me a limited partner in that band because the budget wasn't that big. And that band, Kraft, toured Europe for 4 months or somewhat between 3 and 4 months in the summer of 86, opening for Queen. And we had a lot of social opportunities to hang out with Queen because their record company threw them parties very often. And as the opening act, we were always invited. And I asked Freddie point blank, what's the story behind We Will Rock You? He said, Sandy, we wanted to invent a beat that resonated with not just musicians, not just with drummers, but with everybody, even the 12-year-old girl in Tokyo. We want to invent a beat that resonates with everybody, that as soon as they hear the first couple of notes, they know what beat it is and they can clap along or whatever. So the first lesson there, and I speak to corporate in my speaking career now, and I use We Will Rock You as a lesson for corporate America, for CEOs and stuff. And what I learned from that conversation with Freddie and with Roger Taylor, the drummer, because I know for a fact playing girls just want to have fun the same way every night, every time. And when I was on the road with Lauper, it got kind of boring, and it was what all I can do to maintain my enthusiasm while I was playing a song that was second nature to me. And I said to Roger Taylor, I said, Roger, you're full of enthusiasm playing boom, boom, bat. It's a beat that you can, you know, teach a 12-year-old to play in a minute. And you don't look bored. It's 30 seconds before even the vocals come in and you're playing boom. He goes, Sandy, I'm bored as shit playing that song. But I never want my audience to see me looking bored. I never, you know, you have to repeat something very often in order to resonate with certain people. So that those are the three lessons I got from Freddie and Roger Taylor, and that I give to corporate, is that make your message very, very simple to your people, repeat it often, and never let your people see you looking bored. And Freddie was one of like the Hall of Famers that I work for. They always want to get the audience involved in the success of the show. So if you've seen Queen live ever with Freddie, or you've seen Bohemian Rhapsody in a movie, Freddie does this operatic call and answer with the audience. He would go, hey, oh, and the audience would answer him back. And he would go on for about maybe 30 seconds doing this call and answer. And I asked him about that too. And he said, Sandy, Queen's performance is not a spectator sport. We want the people to get involved and to feel like they're part of the success of the show. We don't want our audience to walk out of the arena or the stadium thinking they observed a great show. We want them to be a part of a great show and feel like they're part of it. So that's another lesson I give to corporate, to make your people feel like they're part of the success of your company or the success of a certain project within your company. What I learned from rock and roll, Jack, I'm applying it to business now, and there's a lot of similarities between, you know, the mindset of a Hall of Famer rock and roller and a leader of a company.
We're talking to Sandy Gennaro, a Hall of Fame legendary rock star. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula. We're with Sandy Gennaro, his autobiography, Beat the Odds in Business and Life. Sandy, I've heard it said that the drummer is the backbone of the operation. Also, the drummer is the engine of the car. How so?
Well, you know what, Jack? It all comes from the drummer. You can have a very shiny, shiny, beautiful car, but if the engine is not firing on all the cylinders, you're not going to have a quality car. It comes from the drummer. It's the drummer is the foundation of the band. You can't have a quality house without a quality foundation. You can't have a quality band without a quality drummer. It all comes from the drummer. The drummer is the heartbeat of the band, the backbone of the band, and the foundation of the band. The band goes as the drummer goes, because the drummer provides the tempo and the consistency, and the tempo, the beat, the tempo of the song has got to stay the same from the beginning of the song to the end of the song, regardless of the changes that happen within the song. And the role of the drummer is to bring everybody on stage with him in sync with his beat in order to perform a common objective, which is to perform to create a musical platform, a musical foundation for the singer to sing upon. And without that foundation, no matter how good the song is, if the drummer is stepping on the groove with fills and shining the spotlight on him and he's getting bored playing, so he's putting fills, hey, look at this Neil Peart fill that's doing a disservice for the song. And if you're doing a disservice for the song, you're doing a disservice for the band. And if you're doing a disservice for the band, you're not going to be there in that drum chair very much longer. You have to be a service-oriented drummer where you provide the consistent foundation. You have a great work ethic. Your tempo is nice and solid, consistent, and that's how you keep a career for over 56 years of being a service-oriented musician, serving the song.
Speaking of the beat, talk to us about Bo Diddley and the Bo Diddley beat.
I love Bo Diddley. I just love Bo Diddley, and I'm glad you brought him up because I was fortunate enough to be the musical director for the last 5 years of his life. Actually, I was a musical director for a couple of tours within the last 5 years of his life, but he was just awesome. And I wrote a book, types of rock and roll beats, and one of those rock and roll beats was the Bo Diddley rhythm. And I asked Bo, where did that rhythm come from? And he said, it's my beat. It's my beat. In actuality, this is for the musicians in the audience, especially the drummers. The Bo Diddley beat is based around 2, 3, 4, bop, 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 bop. Those accents, and you put the fill in. That's the Bo Diddley beat played on a rat tom. But I went in my musical education, I went to find out that bop, 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 bop is actually Latin. It comes from Latin music, and it's called a 3-2 clave. Dot, 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 dot. It's a 3-2 clave rhythm that Bo, somehow being from the South and being around New Orleans and being around the Southern America, Mississippi and Alabama and all of that, he picked up on the New Orleans Latin kind of thing. It's all a hybrid. So Bo Diddley translated that 3-2 clave. He probably didn't know it was actually a 3-2 clave. He was just influenced by the music in the South, and he created a guitar rhythm around that, chunk, 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 chunk. So that's where the Bo Diddley beat was born. And Bo Diddley, to me, he was a black man touring the South in a station wagon with all the gear in the back of his rented hearse, and ended up in the Hall of Fame. You know, touring the South as a black man in the 50s, he had to use segregation was in high gear. And he had to use a separate bathroom, a separate water fountain, et cetera, et cetera. But he ends up in the Hall of Fame. He's a very inspiring gentleman. And I thank God every single day that I had the opportunity to work with Bo Diddley.
We're talking to Sandy Gennaro, who participated on every The Monkees reunion tour from 1987 until the death of Davy Jones in 2012. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with a modern-day Zig Ziglar, Sandy Gennaro. If you want to learn, it's very true. If you want to learn more, www.sandygennaro.com. Sandy, tell us about the Dave in the Doorway story. It changed your life.
Well, I'll try to make this as short and as concise as possible. I was playing a very hot gig in New Haven, Connecticut in the, I think it was the late summer of 1981, and I was in a really big hurry to get out of the dressing room after the show because we had a long overnight drive. I was the last one in the dressing room in a super, super hurry, and there was this guy standing in the doorway with a camera and a pen. I could have just blew by him because I knew what he wanted, an autograph and a picture, but I could have just blew by him because I was being hollered at by my road manager to hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. So, but I didn't. I was flattered that this guy in the doorway was there to see the drummer in the band. He wasn't there to see the artist that was whose name was on the marquee. He was there to see me. And I was always flattered by the idea of an autograph, that people place value on another person putting their name on a piece of paper. When I was 15, walking around the mall with my mother, she used to say to me, "Hey, Sandy, I understand why you dress like those Rolling Stone guys, but why do you carry a pen all the time in the mall?" And I said, "Well, Ma, in case anybody asks for my autograph." So I was already living as if at 15 years old. Anyway, I engaged the guy. I signed his name was Dave. I signed his autograph. I signed his picture. He took a picture with an Instamatic camera, kind of aims it. And then he was he asked me to get him a gig in New York City. I said, I can't recommend you unless I hear you play, Dave. So send me a cassette of your playing, and I'll see what I can do. I gave him my card, my business card. It had my home address and my home phone number on it. And he couldn't believe that I was giving my home address. I said, it's okay, Dave, just go ahead. So I finished the tour. I got home. His cassette was in the mail. I listened to it. It wasn't that good. I recommended him for some gigs. I kept my promise. Nothing really happened. 2.5 years later, he calls me back and he said, I just found this singer in Queens. She's going to be the biggest thing in 1984. I want you to be the drummer in the band. Long story short, I didn't want to join a new baby band and ride in a Winnebago again and share rooms in a hotel or whatever with the band. He goes, Sandy, you may have to do this at the beginning, but listen, come down and hear some of the songs we're working on. We're doing our first record. I got her signed with Epic Records. I signed her to a management deal. She's going to be huge, and I don't want you to miss this opportunity. So I went down to the studio, and it was Cyndi Lauper. And I end based on some of the songs that they were working on, and Girls Just Want to Have Fun and whatever, I went ahead and joined the band based on what I heard of very catchy songs, number one. Number two, the way she looked and her look and her image, I said people are not going to, ignore her. She's going to command an opinion from everybody because of the way she looks and the way her voice sounds. And she's very, very very intelligent woman that knows what she wants and gets what she wants artistically all the time because she believes in herself. So that was, I joined Cyndi's band at the very, very beginning of before that album was released. And 5 months later, she was the biggest artist on the planet. Now, that changed my business life because now I'm involved with a household name. And in 1984, Cyndi Lauper was as popular as Taylor Swift is today. She maybe not as rich and maybe can't sell out stadiums or, you know, for four nights, but she was the biggest artist in America in 1984. And so artistically, it put me on the map in the music business, doing all those network TV shows and MTV and Johnny Carson and Solid Gold and Dick Clark, American Bandstand, all of that. But it changed my personal life, too, because during that Cyndi Lauper tour, November 23rd, 1984, I met the woman backstage in the Charlotte Coliseum in Charlotte, North Carolina. And that woman I met backstage that night ends up to be the woman I'm still with today. And November 23rd of 2024, it'll be 40 years that since the day we met backstage in Charlotte. And so I met the woman of my dreams, my wife, my life partner, and I would not be sitting here in my beautiful house in Nashville without being associated with the strongest, most trustworthy woman on the planet, and that's Sherry Gennaro. And that's my wife. We have a beautiful daughter, Jerry Ann Gennaro, who's now the tour manager for the Pretenders, another Hall of Fame band from the 80s. And I couldn't be my wife and I couldn't be prouder. But you know what? It seems like I'm waving my own flag here and blowing my own trumpet, but I'm not, because I'm trying to bring out the fact that you engage everybody. It's because I wanted to put a smile on Dave in the doorway's face and engage him. And that's, and the God energy, the universe, your higher power smiles upon that when you engage other people and make them happy, or put a smile on their face or give them worthwhile advice or saying hi to somebody in a supermarket, look at the name tag of the person checking your groceries and say hi, engage him or her and thank them for their service. Even when you're anywhere you go where there's somebody waiting on you, whether and they have a name tag, look at the name tag and engage the person, even if it's like, how you doing today? Make that part of your everyday action, engaging people. And you know what? You don't do it for this reason, but the karma of having a mindset like that and taking the blinders off and looking how you can engage people, that the universe smiles upon that. And, you know, I love one of the reasons why I'm talking to you, Jack, because I love the name of this show. Anything is possible. And I am part and parcel to that statement because I don't have any special gifts as a drummer. Nobody in my family growing up was musically inclined. You know, I wasn't one of these boy wonder drummers that played chops and unbelievable solos at 6 years old. I didn't start playing until I was 13, 14. And I don't do anything special on the drum set. I have a work ethic, and I can play songs, and I can play songs either from Bo Diddley to Cyndi Lauper to the Monkees to Pat Travers to Joan Jett, different styles underneath the same rock and roll umbrella, but I become sort of like a chameleon when it comes to, I fit into whatever band I'm asked to play in. But anyway, that being said, I am very, very fortunate to have reached out to Dave in the Doorway in 1981, because I don't know where I would be professionally, and I don't know where I would be personally if I didn't assign an autograph for that one person when I was in extreme hurry.
www.sandygennaro.com. All right, speaking of your personal life, you and Sherry, in your book you talk about the tugboat story. Please.
The tugboat story. I'm trying to think what that story is. What that means.
When you guys were deciding whether you should have a child or not.
I didn't hear you, Jack. You have to speak up a little bit more.
That's the story you're talking about. You went to Florida, I think, to fish, and you were uncertain whether you should have a child or not.
Oh, that story. I love that story. And I'm looking at my buddy Mars right, pictures of him in our scuba outfit. Anyway, I said to my wife, we were married for like 5 years. And I said to my wife, Cher, you know what? She was saying, you know what, honey, we're together for 5 years. We're married. You know, we're in love. Why don't we have a child? And I was kind of insecure about it at first, about the responsibility and all. So I said to my wife, let me go scuba diving with my buddy Mars Cowling. His real name is Peter Cowling. He was a bass player in the Pat Travers Band, the original bass player, and I became a very close friend of his. He's no longer with us, but so I went down scuba dive with my buddy Mars on his boat, and just to chill out, clear my head, and pray for guidance about whether I should go back home with Sherry and try to have our first child. So we're diving, and Mars being the captain, it was his boat, he chose the dive site. And we went diving on this tugboat. It was like a little wreck down. It was maybe in about 60 feet of water. We went down, and he said, hey, you know what, Sandy? I know how you feel about souvenirs. Here's a screwdriver. Anything that's probably picked over right now, but any artifact you can take off that tugboat, you're welcome to keep. So I went down and I pulled off this ring of and if we were video right now, Jack, I can show you. I have the ring hanging over Mars's picture because it was very, very special. I took this off the tugboat. I took this porthole, like a washer, was a brass ring around where the porthole window would be. And I took it off with the screwdriver, pried it off, and brought it up to top. Now, at the top, we took our scuba stuff off, and I have my video camera, and I'm videotaping Mars. Hey, Mars, look what I, you know, he's describing the ring that I took off. He's to the camera, and it's a brass ring. And then I asked him while he was on camera, I said, Mars, what is the name of that tugboat? He had the guidebook there, and he looked it up. And the name of the tugboat that we went diving on, in order for me to, while I was contemplating having a child, the name of that tugboat was the Concepcion. It was a Mexican or a Spanish tugboat, and the Spanish name was the Concepcion, which means a conception. I nearly hit the floor when he said the name of the boat was the Conception. So I went back home. I told my wife the story. I had the ring. I hung the ring in my bedroom. And bada bing, bada boom, 9 months later, our daughter Jerry was born.
We're talking to Sandy Gennaro. Bada bing, bada boom. I don't have that New Jersey accent, but that's the best I got. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on 760 WJR.
You've been listening to your inspirational fireside chat, Anything Is Possible, for nearly 20 years.
This is Anything Is Possible, and I'm Jack Krasula.
But what has Jack been up to lately? Search at AIP Speaker Series and find out. Jack has interviewed thousands of historical voices, some of whom have offered him their philosophy of life, like Tom Izzo.
And Tom writes, "Work hard, persistence always wins out, discipline is the highest form of love. Stay humble."
The great Ernie Harwell.
"My aim is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God."
And the voices of our generation.
"I am reassured continuously that His unfathomable love and mercy are the greatest gifts of my life and my constant source of strength, reassurance, and guidance. His Holiness, Pope Francis."
At AIP Speakers Series is the YouTube channel where all of these jewels can be heard, including some of Anything Is Possible's greatest guests.
And we're with Mitch Albom.
The Little Liar is really a book about truth and lies and the price we pay when we lie.
This is Anything Is Possible, and with Tom Watson.
My father loved to play with the pros at the club. Developed a very quick friendship with Stan and played some golf with him. And then he would ask me to play golf with him and Stan.
Our guest this week was born with a rare disorder characterized by the absence of arms and legs. His name, Nick Vujicic.
Something that every human being actually deals with, Jack. It's the choice of continuing to believe or giving up.
And recordings of the AIP Speaker Series events at St. John's Resort. Go to YouTube and search at AIP Speaker Series. It's free. And remember,
anything is possible.
Spohom. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Sandy Gennaro. His autobiography, Beat the Odds in Business and Life, addresses business management, the music industry, and Sandy's personal life experience as a drummer and now public speaker. He's a modern-day Zig Ziglar. And Zig wrote the first big book, See You at the Top, and 40 times in the book, Sandy, he says, you can get everything in life you want if you help enough other people get what they want.
Bingo.
You believe that, don't you?
I certainly do. And you know what? Based on what you just said, I gotta. Can you recommend a prototypical Zig Ziglar book? You can do that after we get off the air. But I want to read. I've heard of Zig Ziglar, but I never heard it. His philosophy, like you just put it, and it basically aligns with my philosophy.
Consider it done. Okay, there was another man, Dr. Robert Schuller, The Hour of Power, and he had this famous possibility thinker's creed. When faced with a mountain, I will not quit. I will keep on striving until I climb over, find a pass through, tunnel underneath, or simply stay and turn the mountain into a gold mine with God's helping hand.
Right.
Your thoughts on that, please.
I love that, Jack, because it totally aligns with my way of thinking and my way of thinking since I'm a young child. It's possibility mindset. It's growth mindset as opposed to fixed mindset. It's looking at future events with positive visualization and emotion-based visualization, which I've mentioned before, that when you have a visualization of something you would like to accomplish, summon up the emotion that you would have if that situation actually occurred in real time. And at the same time, with that growth mindset, that enthusiastic mindset about future events, at the same time, concurrently, you treat everybody you run into with kindness and respect, and you maintain your work ethic in accordance to what your goal is. So when I was visualizing myself on a big stage, I didn't sit on the couch with a Budweiser with the remote watching Popeye on TV and waiting for the call to come. I rehearsed, I taught the instrument, I practiced every day, and was ready for the opportunity when it came. And again, at the same time, I'm treating everybody with respect. And when you're in that flow of energy, it's impossible to not be successful, or if that's a correct way of saying it. It's you know, I've always believed that when you have faith and you have belief, A, in a power greater than yourself and in yourself and your ability, when you have faith, you believe the unbelievable, you see the invisible, and you receive the impossible. And that's why I love the name of this show, Anything is Possible, and I am living proof that anything is possible. And sometimes your goals are realized according to your visualization and your work ethic and your treating other people, but sometimes things are put in your path for your benefit that you had no idea existed. And that's how I became a speaker. And if this is the last thing we talk about it, I think it's worthwhile for me to mention that I didn't plan on being a successful motivational speaker, or, as you put it, the modern day rock and roll Zig Ziglar. That found me. And how did it find me? Because it answered to my spirit of service, throwing a drumstick to a handicapped person in 2018 in an arena in San Diego. Well, the husband of that woman that I engaged, and I put a smile on her face because I threw her a drumstick after a show. She was in a wheelchair. Well, the husband is a speaker, reached out to me the next day, asked me for my cell phone number on Facebook. I gave him my cell phone number. He called me, over the moon, thankful. And bottom line is, this husband of the woman in the wheelchair that I threw a drumstick to is a motivational speaker. He came to Nashville to speak. He asked me to meet him for a cup of coffee. I didn't really want to meet him. I had no reason really to, in my mind, to meet this guy, because he already thanked me to throw a drumstick to his wife on the phone. But I did. I went downtown Nashville and met with him. And he asked me how I got, how do you got Cyndi Lauper's gig? And I told him the Dave in the Doorway story. Long story short, he said, Sandy, people besides musicians need to hear this. Everybody needs to hear this story of spirit of service. And that's how I became a speaker.
Sandy Gennaro, you're not only a Hall of Fame legendary rock star, more importantly, you're a Hall of Fame human being. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you very much, Jack, and I appreciate this opportunity. I wish you guys the best.
Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom. Believe it.